Hey, it's John Sturman from Ukuleles Unleashed. You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM radio for open ears.
Saturday, May 7th, there is a brand new radio segment on the WGXC morning show at 9 a.m. It's called I Have Seen Niagara, and it's from local artist G. Lucas Crane and Rick Royer. We'll hear the first episode of I Have Seen Niagara towards the end of the hour on the WGXC morning show at 9 a.m. 10 a.m., it's time for the La Femme Fatale episode of Turn on the News. Radio Wonderland is live with Joshua Freed at 10:30 a.m. Then at noon on the countdown, hear new tracks from Ghost Power, David Azzarides, Wet Tuna, and others. In My Room Radio comes on at 1 with music from Tom Zay, Bitchin' Bajas, and the Body Dillaway Head Group. The Radio Art Hour at 3 p.m. features Montreal Audio Placebo Transmissions. At 6 p.m. on the Framework Show, hear works from Anne Germanique, Gintis K, Tavi Sousa, Christina Gione, and Pablo Sanz, among others, on the show where composers take field recordings and present them to you in sound form on the radio. Driftless Turmoil is on at 8 p.m. with Bjork, Kwasi, Marnie Stern, and others, and Mark Harwood is interviewed and featured on the Foxy Podcast at 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM WGXC. Two Hudson Valley-based bands, Frenchy and the Punk and the Dust Bowl Fairies, perform at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock on May 12th at 8 p.m. You can find out more in the WGXC community calendar about the two bands. Frenchy and the Punk is French-born singer and percussionist Samantha Stevenson and American guitarist Scott Helland, who played with Deep Wound. The Dust Bowl Fairies include Ryder Cooley, John B. Wooden, Liz LeJudis, Andrew Stein, and Ruby LaRue. Again, they're at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock, Thursday, May 12th at 8 p.m. Go to the WGXC community calendar online to find out more information about this show and many others.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Rodney Shop in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acra with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Mid-Hudson News reports that May 6th, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in Newburgh talking about how far the U.S. could go to help Ukraine against the Russian invasion. Quote, "The reason we don't want to escalate the war is because Russia has many nuclear weapons which they can easily launch against New York State, Washington, D.C., against California. Any state in the country could be a target," unquote. She says the U.S. is doing everything it can to help. Quote, "We are trying to give Ukraine the tools to win," unquote, she said, also saying she is in favor of more sanctions against Russian oligarchs and military leaders. But Gillibrand did not blame the rising gasoline prices here on the war in Ukraine, saying the U.S. no longer buys oil from Russia. Instead, she blamed the high prices on oil company price gouging and wants a congressional investigation. Read more about this story at MidHudsonNews.com. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that the contract between the town of Greenville and the Greenville Rescue Squad will expire on December 31st, and ambulance officials are concerned over what they say is a lack of communication with the town board. Last week, the Rescue Squad's board of directors met with the press to talk about the future, the proposed contract, and why operational costs are on the rise. Rescue Squad Chair Theodore Nugent Jr. said that in November 2021, the Rescue Squad presented the town with a new five-year contract. Quote, we laid out cost over 5 years. It was given to the town board in executive session, and somehow those numbers along with the cost per thousand ended up on Facebook. So that was kind of concerning and upsetting to us, unquote, Nugent said. The squad has not received any feedback from the board on the proposal since. Quote, we have asked for some response. To this date, we have not heard anything back, unquote, Nugent said. Town Supervisor Paul Macko said no one from the squad has attended a town meeting in months and noted that a rescue squad update is a standing agenda item at the board's monthly meetings. Macko said in 2022, the town paid the squad just under $404,000. The squad's request for 2023 is more than $545,000, and the total increase is yearly over the life of the contract to $607,800 in 2027. Quote, we have no issue with the service they provide. They are excellent, unquote, Macko said. Quote, but it is our objective as the town board to do this as affordably as possible, unquote. Nugent said the amount paid by the town does not even cover payroll expenses, and the squad relies on third-party billing to balance its budget. Quote, this board and this agency are not trying to burden the taxpayers. We are taxpayers, too, unquote, he said. So far in 2022, Greenville Rescue Squad is responding to an average of 50 calls per month. Macko said he would like to negotiate with the squad and would be getting in contact with Nugent. Read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. Noah Eckstein reports for Columbia Green Media that the Hudson Industrial Development Agency has decided it will withhold approval of any prospective hotel applications for the next 90 days. This will allow the IDA time to compose evaluation criteria on how to decide whether a prospective hotel or business is appropriate for the city of Hudson. The agency's board voted unanimously to extend the time period for applications at a public workshop last week. Ryan Wallace, IDA chair and the third ward council member, said, quote, we want to ensure that the IDA board has the opportunity to discuss, refine, and hopefully approve the new criteria so that we can use it to fairly evaluate these hotel projects that are coming before us while doing right by the immediate and neighboring communities, unquote. The IDA promotes, encourages, attracts, and develops job opportunities and economically advantageous commerce and industry in the city of Hudson. The agency also offers businesses needs assessments, site selection, financial incentives, and access to other public sector programs. The IDA will continue to accept applications, but they will not be voted on officially until after the 90-day window closes. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org. I'm Tom Rowe in Acreage with the WGXC Renewable Weather Report. The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a mostly sunny Sunday with a high of just 56 and a northeast wind from 8 to 11 miles per hour. Sunday night should be partly cloudy with a low around 36 and an east wind 5 to 7 miles per hour. Monday should be sunny with a high of 64 and wind from the northeast 7 to 11 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour to spin those local windmills. Monday night, mostly clear is the forecast with a low around 38 and an east wind 6 to 8 miles per hour. Tuesday should be sunny with a high of 67 and a low around 42. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears. Here is this week's Hudson Valley Congressional Report from WGXC from Philip Grant and myself, Tom Rowe, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives of the Hudson Valley in Congress and the candidates who want to replace them. Current Democrat representatives Antonio Delgado, Paul Tonko, and Sean Maloney vote with the positions of President Joe Biden 100% of the time, according to the 538.com website. Republican Elise Stefanik voted with Biden's positions 18% of the time.
Louis Fair Sedoni and Nicholas Pandos report in the New York Times that Governor Kathy Hochul picked Representative Antonio Delgado as her new lieutenant governor. The choice is considered strange for two reasons. Typically, a governor-lieutenant governor ticket includes one candidate representing New York City's large population, and the choice makes it more difficult for Democrats to hold on to Delgado's 19th congressional district. Delgado, though, is not mired in controversy, an important consideration for the replacement of Brian Benjamin, who was indicted on federal bribery charges last month, leading to his resignation. Democrats voted May 2nd in Albany to change the state election law, allowing Benjamin to take his name off the ballot and Delgado to put his name on the ballot. Hochul said, And I quote, having won competitive primary and general elections for Congress, Representative Antonio Delgado is a battle-tested campaigner who has the experience to serve New Yorkers and the work ethic to get our party's message out to voters, unite communities, and lift up Democratic candidates statewide. In the June primary election, Delgado gets two Latino women opponents, Diana Arena, a former New York City council member, and Anna Maria Archila, a progressive activist. Which Democrats might run for Delgado's New York 19th district seat is unclear. So far, Gareth Rhodes, a former state official who previously attempted to win the seat, has ruled out running for the seat now. The New York Times reports that according to two people familiar with his thinking, Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan is seriously considered running for the now open seat. Republican Mark Molinaro, the Dutchess County executive who ran for governor in 2018, will run against whichever Democrat emerges for the seat. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Governor Kathy Hochul's decision, announced May 3rd, to make Representative Antonio Delgado lieutenant governor, adds another vote to the summer elections in New York, with all sorts of cascading effects across the ballots. Delgado will take the state oath of office this month at a date to be determined. Hochul said, and I quote, the only question is the exact timing he will resign from Congress. There is work to be finished before he assumes these responsibilities, end quote. The day before, former Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, recently indicted on corruption charges, removed himself from the ballot after the legislature passed a law to allow political nominees charged with a crime to vacate a party ticket. So now Delgado will appear on the ballot for the statewide primary election for Lieutenant Governor, scheduled for June 28th as Hochul's running mate. Then, Spectrum News reports a special election for Delgado's 19th district seat must be set within 10 days of the resignation and must be held within 3 months. Mark Molinaro, the Republican Dutchess County executive who is already running for the seat, will likely be on the ballot against an, at this point, unknown Democrat. Assemblymember Martiza Davila of Brooklyn told City and State about Hochul's decision, and I quote, you left an open seat in Congress. This is what we're trying to avoid, end quote. She said she feels confident that the seat will return to Republican hands now. Davila added, and I quote, she has to live with her own choices, end quote. Other Democrats were more optimistic about retaining the seat. State Senator Brad Holyman of Manhattan told City and State, and I quote, we have strong Democratic candidates, I'm sure, looking at that seat. I would expect a worthy successor in the Democratic nomination, end quote. State Democratic Party Chair Jay Jacobs told City and State that the party has several potential candidates in mind for the seat, but declined to say who exactly. Two local politicians are floating their names so far. Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan, who lost to Delgado in the Democratic primary in 2018, hinted at trying again in a May 3rd tweet. Ryan wrote, referring to the news that the Supreme Court would overturn Roe v. Wade, and I quote, after last night's devastating news, it is clear now more than ever we need champions in Congress who will protect fundamental rights and freedom and fight back against Washington extremists. So stay tuned, end quote. Anonymous sources also claim State Senator Michelle Hinchey of Saugerties may run for the seat. A source with knowledge of the senator's plans said, and I quote, she's assessing where she can best help our communities, whether that's in Albany or Washington, end quote. Hinchey, in her own election, turned the 46th Senate district in the Hudson Valley from Republican control to Democrats in 2020. The source added, and I quote, everything is on the table, end quote. Both could run, and because redistricting has been thrown out and maps are being withdrawn, the primary election for congressional seats will now happen in August. And if a current office holder such as Ryan or Hinchey runs for the Democrats, they will need to find a replacement. Hinchey right now is running for re-election this fall against Republican Rich Amador.
Kate Lisa is reporting for New York State of Politics that State Senator Michelle Hinchey announced on May 6th that she has chosen to seek re-election to a second term in the state legislature's upper chamber, ending speculation that she would launch a congressional run. Hinchey, a Democrat from Saugerties, said earlier in the week she was thinking about seeking the Democratic nomination in the 19th Congressional District after Governor Kathy Hochul announced the appointment of U.S. Representative Antonio Delgado as the state's lieutenant governor. Delgado, a Democrat from Rhinebeck, has held the seat since 2019 and will step down soon with a special election for the seat and then another in November. Hinchey announced her plan to seek re-election on Twitter. Quote, "I ran for office because that's how I could best serve my community, to give upstate residents a real seat at the table," unquote, Hinchey said. Quote, "When scenarios change, reflection on where the work is best continued, where you make the biggest difference, and what's truly at stake is brought to the forefront. But with the events of this week and the impending and detrimental Supreme Court decision to overturn a person's right to choose, it's never been more clear that state governments are where the work is most important. With our federal government in turmoil, states are now the active battlegrounds in our fight to protect our democracy and to ensure equitable and just policies that protect all of us," unquote, she wrote. Retired State Trooper Republican Richard Amador of Rensselaerville announced in March that he is running against Hinchey for a second time. He lost his bid for the seat in 2020. Hinchey did not endorse another Democrat for the congressional nomination. Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan, a Democrat who lost the congressional nomination to Delgado in a 2018 primary, was the first person this week to announce that he is considering a run for the federal seat. On Twitter May 6, Ryan said he will make a decision to run for Congress soon and supported Hinchey's Senate campaign. Also on May 6, City and State New York reporter Rebecca C. Lewis wrote on Twitter that a, quote, "source with knowledge says that Democratic leaders in New York 19 have lined up behind Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan for the special election to replace soon-to-be Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado," unquote. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. This is Tom Rowe with Wave Farm with the WGXC Radio News daily update on what's going on in broadcast news. Aaron Mack reports for Slate about spam robocalls. Do you remember the national Do Not Call registry beginning in 2003? Do you remember the last time you received an automated phone message? Do you remember the last time you read about some robocall scam targeting local seniors? The federal government has definitely not eliminated the scourge of robocalls. In March, there were 4.3 billion robocalls made in the United States, according to the spam blocking company Umail. There has been a lot of online finger-pointing lately at Ajit Pai, the industry-friendly chair of the Federal Communications Commission during the Trump administration. Pai did not support a 2015 anti-robocalling rule from the Obama-era FCC that would have expanded the definition of an auto-dialer to include any device that had the capacity to make robocalls, even if they weren't modified to do so. The plan passed without Pai's support, but in 2018, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit struck it down, saying it was too broad. Pai did not appeal the decision, but celebrated, describing the 2015 rule as, quote, "yet another example of the prior FCC's disregard for the law and regulatory overreach," unquote. But Margot Saunders, senior counsel at the National Consumer Law Center, argues the court decision did not lead to a record number of robocalls. At play, she said, quote, "were very esoteric issues that had much more to do with the legality of non-scammers like debt collectors. Chairman Pai wasn't particularly aggressive, but you can't lay the problem at his door," unquote, said Saunders. Quote, "there is no proceeding that he failed to appeal that would have made the difference in this, in my opinion," unquote. Saunders instead says phone calls now go through multiple providers instead of just one, which makes stopping phone scams more difficult. Mack ends the story asking Saunders if there is any one person who could be blamed for so many robocalls now, and she replied, quote, "Alexander Graham Bell," unquote. More about this story in Slate. In popular culture, the wireless, untethered charger for a phone is like a hovercraft, something long promised but never delivered. Last week, though, WeCharge founder and chief business officer Ori Moore gave an interview to TechCrunch where he claimed that Belkin would release a specific, quote, "center stage consumer product," unquote, to charge phones remotely later this year. But the next day, however, Belkin spokesperson Jen Wei said nothing is imminent. Quote, "currently our agreement with WeCharge only commits us to research and development on some product concepts, so it's too early to comment on the timing of viable consumer products," unquote, Wei told Ars Technica. Quote, the Belkin method is to thoroughly investigate technology viability and perform deep user testing before committing to a product concept. Here at Belkin, we only launch products when we confirm technical feasibility backed by deep consumer insights, unquote. What we do know about that research and development is that Y-Charge's technology has a small mounted transmitter plugged into an AC or DC outlet to, quote, convert electricity into safe infrared beams, unquote, the company's website says. The transmitter sends up to 1 watt of power to devices holding a Y-Charge receiver within a 40-foot range and line of sight. The radio wave receivers then turn that light into power to charge phones and computer notebooks. Infrared waves are electromagnetic waves that have frequency range around 300 gigahertz and can only travel a short distance. A Belkin official makes clear this cable and pad-free wireless charging technology is coming soon, just not right away. Quote, we are excited to uncover the full potential of WeCharge's unparalleled over-the-air wireless charging technology, unquote, said Brian Van Harlingen, the CTO at Belkin. Quote, the future of charging has been transitioning from wired to wireless for years now, and we anticipate over-the-air wireless charging to accelerate this evolution, unquote. James Careless reports for Radio World that the British Broadcasting Corporation's World Service has turned 90 years old. It began as the BBC Empire Service in 1932, sending shortwave signals around the globe. Quote, created 10 years after the BBC itself was founded, the BBC World Service was there to send voices out of the air, which sounds like a poem by Keats, but are actually the words of King George V, unquote, said Stephen Titherington, senior head of content for the BBC World Service English. Quote, since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, it has had a different relevancy to people in terms of sharing what is happening within the world, with also a chance for people to add their voice to what needs to be heard, unquote. The BBC World Service provided alternative information to people in fascist countries in the 1930s and 1940s, then pivoted as a Cold War broadcaster, and now beams in signals to conflict zones in Ukraine, Yemen, Palestine, and Afghanistan. Lately, it has focused on local broadcasts and streaming media while cutting back on shortwave and ending shortwave service to North America. Quote, one thing that has been consistent over the years is the BBC's commitment to independent news, unquote, said Dr. Kim Andrew Elliott, retired Voice of America audience research analyst, radio host, and now producer-presenter of Shortwave Radiogram, heard on shortwave stations WINB and WRMI. The Voice of America, a similar radio service from the United States, always seemed more like propagandist than the BBC. Quote, to be sure, the BBC European services had partisan commentaries during World War II, but the news remained factual mostly. Since World War II, BBC World Service has been the de facto standard for comprehensive and objective news, unquote, Elliott says. As of late 2021, the BBC broadcasts in 40 languages, including Amharic, Gujarati, Igbo, Korean, Marathi, Pidgin, Punjabi, Serbian, Telugu, Tigrinya, and Yoruba. In March, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the BBC World Service announced it is broadcasting, quote, 4 hours of English news daily on two shortwave frequencies, both of which can be received clearly in Kyiv and parts of Russia, unquote, said a BBC media release. The shortwave frequencies are 15735 kilohertz, operating from 1400 to 1600 UTC, and on 5875 kilohertz from 2000 to 2200 UTC. Quote, the audience for the BBC's Russian language news website more than tripled its year-to-date weekly average, with a record reach of 10.7 million people in the last week compared to 3.1 million. In English, BBC.com visitors in Russia were up 252% to 423,000 last week, unquote, a BBC press release said when the war was 2 weeks old. Elliott agrees that the service is often most needed where it is least wanted by the local government. Quote, we have seen in more and more countries censorship and blocking of the internet. Shortwave can deliver information across national boundaries independent of the internet. Satellite television also sidesteps the internet, but satellite dishes are conspicuous. Shortwave reception is simpler, cheaper, and more discreet. And my shortwave radiogram project shows that text and images can be transmitted by old analog shortwave transmitters and received on any shortwave radio with decoding by an app on a PC or mobile device, unquote, Elliott says. Read more about this story at Radio World. So much about Motorola's $130 car radio in 1930 for a Model A deluxe coupe cost $540 and was the first commercially successful car radio, according to Car and Driver magazine. Inside Radio reports that many radio business officials continue to worry about the threat to the dominance of AM and FM signals in those vehicles. Quote, what's driving a lot of these threats is the fact that you have 12 large global technology audio companies coming into the dash very aggressively to steal your listeners, unquote, said Joe D'Angelo, senior vice president of broadcast at Xperi, a company working with broadcasters to maintain radio's dashboard dominance. Apps such as Apple CarPlay and Android Auto on a dashboard screen look like what consumers see on their smartphones. There's also Android Automotive, an operating system which gives Google control, and of course any Bluetooth connection gets listeners any sound those phones can also receive. Currently, AM/FM radio continues to lead in-car listening with 56% of audio time there tuned in over the air and increasingly through Bluetooth radio signals. Of course, 56% is a lot smaller than the old days when singing was radio's only competition in a car. Xperi is asking what information people in cars listening to the radio want on their dashboards. Emergency weather information, song information, game scores, and the name of the host all scored high. Xperi CEO Steve Newberry said, quote, we are in the process of embracing the screenification of radio, helping the industry move from being an audio medium to being a medium that can compete with Spotify, Pandora, and Sirius XM and all of our other competitors that we have on the dashboard, unquote. Read more radio news at wavefarm.org. On May 6, 1937, one of radio's most famous broadcasts was recorded. The hydrogen in the German passenger airship LZ-129 Hindenburg burst into flames as the new airship attempted to land in Manchester Township, New Jersey, killing 36 people. Herbert Morrison's eyewitness report for radio station WLS in Chicago of the Hindenburg disaster was not broadcast live, but recorded for a report that was broadcast the next day and has lived through the ages. It aired on other radio stations, and the audio was dubbed onto newsreel footage and shown in movie theaters. While the scale of the sinking of the Titanic was slightly larger, this was the first major disaster with a narrator calling the play-by-play, with a visual recording synced. Few people at the time had ever witnessed or listened to 36 people die at once in a terrifying scene that rivals today's Hollywood special effects. And Morrison's radio narration was the first time listeners heard someone in real time explaining what was happening during a deadly disaster, not explaining it afterwards. Watching the Challenger space shuttle disaster or the World Trade Center fall are modern-day broadcast comparisons. While today's anchors and correspondents can keep calm in most any circumstance, Morrison's call of the accident is more human, as he clearly is overwhelmed by what he is seeing, making the, quote, oh, the humanity, unquote, phrase ring through the years. Here is the recording of Herbert Morrison from WLS in Chicago describing the Hindenburg disaster on May 6th, 1937.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity and all the furniture speeding around it. I told you... I can't even talk to people. His friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. I can't. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because...